This is Speaking Freely. This week, Oregon's governor told lawmakers they should not end their session without passing her housing plan. She says it's the number one issue for people across the state. Senate Bill 1537 includes $400 million for moderate income housing and things that support it, like roads and sewers. It would create a housing production and accountability office. Here's what Governor Kotek said when she testified this week.
I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm super excited to be talking about this bill and talking about housing. I feel like I'm chief architect, chief cheerleader, and just like, hey, can we get this done? And here's why. We should always remember the why we're here. Traveled around the state last year, every county, everybody talked about housing. Ontario, Silverton, Grants Pass. Stories were a little different, but a lot of similarities. I want to live in this community. I want to work in this community. I don't have a place to live. This is affecting our economy. It's affecting the health of our communities. And we are seeing the ultimate result of not enough housing that is affordable, and that is our homelessness crisis. A lot of things have happened over the last two decades to bring us here, but I know we can solve it. I also want to emphasize that this bill, Senate Bill 1537, and I want to join the chair and thank you everybody who's worked on this in the last 7 months. This is how public policy should work. We have a significant problem facing our state. We had some proposals last year that didn't work for everyone. People didn't walk away. They sat down and worked on it. The size of this challenge requires a full menu of solutions, which is what you see in this bill. You're going to hear from the people who can tell you all the details. But I believe this bill is bold and balanced. It's comprehensive. It will provide the spark to jumpstart the building of new housing that we need to see across the state. It's clear about affordability goals. If you pass this bill, we'll have some of the strongest affordability goals around new development if a community takes advantage of a UGB expansion tool that's in this bill. Not every community needs that, but if they do, we're going to say, here's how we want to see it happen. We need to help our local governments. I've met with mayors and county commissioners across the state. They're like, we need help. I want to praise the legislature for doing the housing needs analysis work last year with House Bill 2001. And our communities are like, we need help. We need those model codes that the housing office can provide that's in this bill. We need technical assistance. We need infrastructure. They know what they need. We as a state must be a partner in making sure that housing happens. I also know that the process means there might be an amendment to this bill. That's the process. But what we can't see happen is that this legislature leaves at the end of their session without this bill. There's money in this bill. And bet, you know what? You have the power. You have the resources to allocate to this bill. You can say we are going to do housing production differently over the next 3, 5, 10 years, because that is what Oregonians are asking us to do. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. There are a lot of people working on this bill. They know the details. I just really urge you to get it done. So thank you and look forward to the conversation.
Many developers and lawmakers are supporting the bill, including this state senator from Clackamas County.
My name is Mark Meek, state senator for Senate District 20, Oregon City, Gladstone, and Happy Valley, and I'm very thankful to be here to speak in strong support of Senate Bill 1537, which will make life more affordable and accessible for many Oregonians. There's no more urgent need this session than to pass this legislation, so I do appreciate the governor's leadership on this. We need over 500,000 new homes by 2040 here in Oregon, and to hit this mark, we must double our annual rate of production, both for in home construction. Recognizing the urgency, Governor Kotek has set a yearly goal to build 36,000 housing units and acknowledged the need to look closely at our land use laws. Builders and landowners need more land for housing, including affordable options for low to moderate income families. Senate Bill 1537 will allow cities and builders to collaboratively include new land within their urban growth boundary, aiming for diverse, affordable housing and public services. The bill safeguards farmlands, forest lands, and environmental resources, applying only to areas not classified as such, or those set for future expansion, that is, urban reserves. In fact, even if this bill is to use all the maximum land supply available, it will bring in only a very small, less than a millionth of a percent of Oregon's available land mass in the state of Oregon. So the concerns about land use are not necessarily proportional when we're talking about 125 acres and 75 acres.
And that was Clackamas County District 20 State Senator Mark Meek. However, some environmentalists are expressing doubts.
My name is Julia DeGraw, and I'm the coalition director at the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, and part of my job there is directing the Oregon Conservation Network. And on behalf of tens of thousands of members and supporters across the state of Oregon, I would like to register our opposition to SB 1537 as it is currently written. We are grateful to the governor and her staff, especially Matt. We've worked with tirelessly for the progress that has been made to improve this legislation that we see in this bill today. We have many pieces of this bill that we strongly support, including much needed infrastructure funding and climate smart housing incentives. However, we have been clear from the beginning that the reason HB 3414 became a major threat in 2023 was because the UGB expansion sections and these issues have not fully been resolved in SB 1537. When the OCN voted to make SB 1537 a major threat to healthy Oregon this year, we did not make the decision lightly. This testimony is intended to clarify a position that the large urban growth boundary expansions allowed in the bill are detrimental to urgently solving our affordable housing crisis and to our state's environmental values. Limited infrastructure funding should be laser focused inside UGBs. OCN opposes the bill until the large UGB expansion portion of the bill is removed, but leaving in the 15-acre expansion section is okay. And short of that, until the acreage is significantly reduced, we cannot remove the major threat status. We also urge the timeline of the 10 years to be reduced to 5 to avoid undermining the ONA process, which could lead to more affordable options than this bill would provide. We all agree Oregon has a housing crisis. SB 1537 has tremendous potential to urgently and effectively tackle this crisis with impactful policies that boost affordable middle housing production and the housing Oregonians need the most right now. We urge you to amend this bill so we can all support this transformative housing policy.
That was testimony from Julia DeGraw with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. The national average price of a home this year is roughly $372,000. But the average price in Oregon is more than $510,000, ranking it as the 9th most expensive state to own a home. That makes it tough for the average person in the workforce to own homes. Lucetta Elmer represents District 24 in the state legislature, which includes most of Yamhill County. Elmer and other lawmakers are working on House Bill 4134, called Housing Oregon's Workforce. It would give grants to cities for infrastructure projects to benefit housing developments, with developers pitching in by making at least 30% of their units affordable for workforce income households.
Okay, so House Bill 4134, Housing Oregon's Workforce, or we can shorten that to HOW. So we all recognize there's a problem. We have a problem of housing shortage in Oregon, and we have a problem with infrastructure. So this bill is looking to address both of those. We rank 47th nationally for housing production, which is sad. You know, we're way down there at the bottom in how many houses that we're producing for our citizens. And we also have a lack of infrastructure dollars. And I come from a rural district, and I hear that come up over and over and over, that my small cities just really struggle to keep up with the infrastructure costs and to be able to pass that cost on to the citizens who are paying into those utility bills is tough when, let's say, you only have 600 people. That are all paying for utility. That's really hard to try to gather money from such a small amount. Housing affordability limit excludes large portion of Oregon's workforce. And specifically, this bill is around sort of that workforce housing. So we're thinking firefighters, teachers, nurses. So the solution, how? Housing Oregon's workforce. We're looking at projects that are site-specific infrastructure dollars for shovel-ready projects. These projects are already inside the UGB, and they're ready to go. Projects are a direct correlation to housing production. The city of Mint came to me last year, early on, and they're the ones that really are the brainchild of this, and they had this idea, which they pitched, and then we've spent many months working together on this, and I really think it's such a smart concept of how we're merging public tax dollars with private dollars to get the biggest bang for our buck. So we're looking at cities that are under 50,000. And we did an ask throughout. We reached out through the Mayor's Association to all cities under 50,000. And we asked if they had any land that was already in the UGB, that was site shovel ready to go, that was maybe not able to produce housing because there was a stop because of infrastructure. So that was kind of the general parameters of how we started and to seek out properties that would work in this bill. The project needs to be completed within 24 months, the infrastructure portion, and then the housing within 60 months. So we did put some time restrictions on there. We're really trying to be efficient and get these housing doors or get these doors open as quickly as possible. If the local developer decides they want to be a part of this and they want to go ahead and have public dollars pay for the infrastructure, then in exchange, they're going to make 30% of the housing units available for 130% AMI or less. So it's sort of that give-get package, which I love. So the projected new housing unit availability, it's going to produce over 1,000 doors, and we're looking at 10 major projects throughout the state. So coming from a business background, I didn't want to mandate. We can talk all day long about affordability, but the standards by which this is defined must pencil for the folks building our housing, and I understood that. I also realize how responsible I want to be, as we all want to be, with state tax dollars. So as we were just really trying to put this all together, we didn't want to be controlling, but we also wanted to put parameters around it that we could see the biggest success. So that is why there's certain parts of the policy that are so important, and the integrity of this bill is so important to me. I mean, yes, we want these projects to get funded. We want to see doors get open, but the policy piece is beautiful, and I really hope that that can stay intact so that we can have that give-get relationship. There's going to be a little over 1,000 units of new housing. The total, I think that might have been read in the bill. I'm not sure if it was the exact same amount, but a little under $25 million. And we're looking at street improvements, sewer system expansions, utility lines. I believe there's some water projects in there. And it comes out to around $22,000 a door that we would be allocating for those infrastructure needs. One of the issues that we identified in these rural cities is that a lot of times you have cities that just have really small staffs, and it's hard for them to navigate grant processes or to even know exactly what all of their options are when they're looking to try to develop out their cities. So we are doing a direct allocation. The money would go directly to the cities and bypass an agency to where it might get held up. So I think that is another way that we can make sure that this is efficient. So there's no extra program to set up, and hopefully that will help these cities with small staffs. And affordability is targeted to that workforce. So we're looking at teachers, nurses, firefighters, police officers. And then to just really talk about that public-private partnership, investing state dollars efficiently and effectively for the good of our communities. And I love that private-public partnership.
The next step is a work session scheduled for Tuesday. People with average incomes in Oregon struggle with the high cost of housing. There are several bills that Oregon lawmakers are looking at. One of them is House Bill 4134, the Housing Oregon's Workforce Bill. Beth Castor is a realtor from McMinnville who shared her experiences when she testified this week.
I live and work here in McMinnville, Oregon. I've lived here since 1994, and I've been a licensed realtor in Oregon since 2000. As a realtor, I witness every single day the fact that our community is in a housing shortage crisis right now. And I do not use this word lightly. It's a stumbling block for many of us, for companies working who want to bring in workers. We have trouble finding appropriate, adequate housing for them. These workers will often need to live in Salem or Beaverton areas and commute to their new job. This applies across the board to not only the properties for sale, but also for rentals. This ongoing crisis contributes, in my opinion, to driving the prices of rents and properties up, often out of reach for teachers, firefighters, medical personnel, and tech workers. In order for our community to grow new jobs, this means providing middle housing has become imperative. HB 4134 provides a vehicle for an already approved subdivision to move forward with the infrastructure needed. The need for this legislation is urgent and critical to help our community and many communities like ours to resolve our housing crisis.
And that was Beth Castor, a realtor from McMinnville, talking about Oregon House Bill 4134, the Housing Oregon's Workforce Bill. Do you think you're paying a fair amount of taxes for the services you're getting? Do you think you're better or worse off? Do you think your county is heading in the right direction? If you've answered questions like these lately, you may be among the hundreds of voters answering questions from pollsters. They took the pulse of voters in the three-county Portland metro area, trying to determine what they're feeling and what they're most concerned about. Now results are in for the survey of 500 voters in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties taken in mid-December. DHM Research President Michelle Neves describes what they asked and what they found out.
We're here to talk about economy survey that the Portland Metro Chamber conducts annually. And part of the purpose of that is to track opinions in the region of how people feel about the economy, economic opportunities, jobs, and various community issues. We talked to some people on the phone, others we text and ask them to take the survey online. We talked to 500 voters in the region, the three counties, Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, and we do have an oversample of City of Portland voters. This was conducted mid-December. It took about 12 minutes to complete. Overall, for the region across all three counties, what we see is that 51% think that their county is on the wrong direction, which is a continuation of fairly negative sentiment that we've had for the past few years. And we do see that residents of Multnomah County are more negative than other counties, with 69% of Multnomah County people feeling that county is headed in the wrong direction. We also asked people about their quality of life, whether it's getting better, staying the same, getting worse. And we see here that a majority, 78%, think that quality of life is getting worse, which is similar to what we saw last year. When we ask them what is the top issue they think needs to be addressed in the region, homelessness tops the mentions with 40%. It has been the top concern for the past several years, and that's true, honestly, statewide. Public safety is the second highest priority. And then this year, we found that 16% mentioned drug use or addiction, and this edged out affordable housing. So that's actually a change from previous years. About 7% mentioned drug use last year. So that's about double in people mentioning that as a specific concern, overtaking affordable housing in the top three there. So that is a pretty notable change and shift that we're seeing when voters are given the option to identify in their own words the top issue. Homelessness, cost of living, and crime rate top the list of things they are most concerned about. When looking at economic issues, it's cost of living and affordable housing that people are most concerned about versus jobs per se. That undoubtedly makes sense with inflation and the cost of living here in Portland. It's the expenses, it's the money outgoing that is hitting people's pocketbook more than worrying about jobs. And then just to give some historical context, how concerned people were about those top three issues over the past several years. And it has been fairly stable the past couple of years. There's a high amount of concern about these issues. And what we hear in open-ended comments is frustration that I'm not necessarily seeing progress on some of these issues. And so level of concern has stayed high. When we asked people to think more about their own economic situation and the economic outlook, we see more negative sentiment than we've seen in the past. Half of voters, and relatively fewer, are saying that they are about the same. It's fairly sobering. The opportunities that people are seeing, or in this case, feeling a little bit pessimistic about, that are available to them living here. I will note that we saw some differences regionally. City of Portland voters, fewer say they are worse off compared to the rest of the Tri-County. So there's a little bit of a difference there, in certainly in what they're feeling. And then there's either outlook or the actual opportunities, maybe still feeling fairly positive in the city of Portland. When we ask them more about economic opportunities that they see for themselves and their household, negativity is, I would say, more tied with their split on being negative or positive. Negative opinions have actually crossed over to be higher than positive opinions for the first time in the several years that we've been tracking this question.
And that was Michelle Neves. And John Horvick, who is also with DHM Research, is describing a very partisan divide when it comes to how people in the three counties view the city of Portland and their taxes.
I'm going to start with downtown Portland visits and some other information to talk a little bit about taxes. Start with downtown Portland. So one of the things we wanted to benchmark and track is just visits to downtown. We just simply asked how many times in the last 30 days have you visited downtown Portland. Now, we didn't provide precise definitions of downtown, but I think generally people have a perception because we track it across time. We can see how attitudes might change. 46% said they haven't visited downtown even once in the last 30 days. So about 53-54% say they visited at least once. 34% have visited 1 to 5 times, 10% 6 to 10. You take anybody, pick randomly in the region, odds are about 50-50 whether they visited downtown in the last 30 days. There are differences, of course, by some demographics, and these won't be terribly surprising, but they're good to know. So one is age. As people who are older are less likely to have visited than those who are younger. So about 20 percentage point difference between those who are 18 and 34 and those who are 55 and older. So that's pretty significant. Of course, geography plays a big role, right? Those who live in the city of Portland, those who are close by, are more apt to have visited downtown than those who live further away. And then there is this difference by partisanship. Now, some of that's going to overlap with these other variables, particularly geography. Like, we know the city of Portland is more Democratic leaning than the rest of the region, although most of the region, of course, is Democratic leaning. Just the intensity varies from one place to another. But Portland has become a place. Downtown Portland has become like a physical place where people visit, but it's also become sort of a political symbol. And we do, I think, see some of that in these results by party, where 64% of Republicans haven't visited downtown, almost double what it is for Democrats. So there is something about the way that downtown is viewed through people's ideology and partisanship that is affecting their willingness to come to the city. The number of times people have visited downtown Portland among city of Portland voters, and then for those who live in the rest of the Tri-County area, there's an increase this year by 9 percentage points of those who didn't visit downtown even once. So this year, 55% of those in the rest of the Tri-County area said they did not visit downtown in the last 30 days versus 46% last year. So there is some evidence of a decline in the number of visits among people who live farther away from the city. But we asked if people feel safe or not visiting downtown Portland. So 55% of those in the region say that they feel unsafe during the day. Kind of a slim majority. 55% say they feel unsafe downtown Portland during the day. 81% say they feel unsafe at night. Just to break down between city of Portland voters and those who live in the rest of the region, during the day, there is some variation. There's 63% of those who live the rest of the region feel unsafe during the day versus 41% of Portland voters. There's less of a difference at night. You might be wondering, don't people always say that they feel unsafe at nighttime? And we've been tracking this for a while. So not all of these are surveys that we've done for the Portland Metro Chamber. Some of them are surveys we've done for other projects, but we have been consistently asking this question since 2015. So city of Portland voters only, okay? Because not all the previous surveys were the entire region. Some of them are just with Portlanders. In 2015, 35% of Portlanders said that they did not feel safe in downtown Portland at night. And it walked its way up to 77% last year, 74% this year. So it's not the case that people have always felt this way. This is a change. Now, we've asked during the day a little bit less frequently. The number at night, it didn't get worse this year. In fact, it improved 3 percentage points. And there is a more significant decline, feeling unsafe during the day, from 51% to 41% from 2022 to 2023. So that's an improvement, although we're nowhere near where we were a decade ago. In taxes, we started with a sort of a global question. This is, considering the services that you received, do you consider the taxes you pay too high, about right, or are they too low? Of course, it's no surprise that folks aren't saying that their taxes are too low at just 2%. But 69% are saying, and this is in the Tri-County, by the way, 69% say that their taxes are too high considering the services that they're receiving. Now, that's up from 61% in 2022. So that is an 8 percentage point increase in the last year. I found these numbers really illuminating because, particularly with taxes, we often see these really big gaps in partisanship where Democrats and Republicans are living in two different worlds. And there's some of that here. There is a difference between Democrats and Republicans, but it's not nearly as big as we would see historically. 84% of Republicans saying that their taxes are too high relative to the services that they receive, but it's a clear majority of Democrats, 62%. It's a clear majority of non-affiliated voters at 67%. Those are sort of the gaps that we typically see, and it's because Democrats are moving up, not because Republicans are moving down. I'd also really call out breakdowns by county. Democrats, liberals, yes, tax voters tend to live in Portland and Multnomah County. 76% of Multnomah County residents say that their taxes are too high relative to their services they receive. That's higher than Clackamas County. Compared to 2022, that's a 10 percentage point increase in Multnomah County. It's about an 11 point increase in Clackamas County, and there's no change in Washington. Clackamas County isn't maybe not a surprise, but there is something in Multnomah County that's happening. To see a 10-point jump from 2022 to 2023 and to be higher than the other counties is significant. And although we don't have great historical data on this particular question, I suspect it's a new development. So we asked about just a few taxes that voters have supported at the ballot and asked them if they would support them again or support them now. One is the Metro Regional Homeless Services Tax. 48% say that they would re-up the Metro Homeless Services Tax. 47% say that they would oppose it. It's just barely over 50% in Multnomah and in Washington counties, and well below 50% in Clackamas counties. It's 31% in Clackamas County, 51% in Multnomah, 55% in Washington. There are fairly large gaps by income. Among households or voters with incomes less than 50K, it's 63% support. Among voters with 150K plus incomes, it's just 36% support. The Metro Homeless Services Tax passed with 58% of the vote when it was on the ballot in 2020. The second one, Preschool for All, this passed at the ballot with 64% of the vote. Now among Multnomah County voters, it's 51% support, 45% opposed. So quite a difference there. Pretty large gaps by income. Among those with $50,000 incomes or less, you're at 72% support. But among those with 150K plus incomes, you're at 34% support. So a big drop from where it was on the ballot and some big differences by income. And then the Portland Clean Energy Fund passed at the ballot 2018 with 65% of the vote. Right now, Portland voters are at 55% support, 41% opposed. So still a pretty clear majority saying yes, but nothing like the level of support it had in 2018. We've been tracking level of trust in local elected officials going back to 2019. Percentages of voters in the region who say they have a lot or some trust in their local elected officials. That 25% is important now because that's where we are today. I just think that is in context. In 2019, that wasn't that long ago. That number was 63% support. I think there's a temptation to just assume that voters distrust politicians, elected officials, but it was just recently that 63% in the region said that they did trust them. So there's a big decline over the years, and now just one out of four are saying that they trust their local elected officials.
John Horvick is with DHM Research. You're listening to Speaking Freely with Annette Newell. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you have an idea for a topic you would like to hear about on the show, please send me an email about it, annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. Glad you chose to join us here on your favorite Alpha Media radio station, and be sure to check out our Speaking Freely podcast on KXL.com. Have a great week.